I'm Claire and I'm going to talk to you today about mobile health. So just before I give you an outline of what I'm actually going to discuss with you, I'll just tell you a little bit about me. So I did, as Steve was saying, I did psychology here at the University of Glasgow, and it was an MA, it was a single honours. I took positive psychology, and all the while throughout the honours, I have always been interested in technology. So I've always tried to find ways to work it in. I was actually quite close to taking psychology as a joint. I don't know if anyone's heard of the Hattie building down in university, Gardens, which is Humanities Advanced Technology Information Institute. And they talk about things like artificial intelligence and cyber psychology and identity online, things like that. So I was quite keen to take that, but ended up taking a single honours psychology, but I've luckily managed to bring back those interests together. I've underlined that it's an interest in technology. I didn't have any, and I still don't have any, like, coding skills, so I have learned quite a bit about the technology, but I wouldn't say that I have any kind of developer skills at the moment. So what am I doing now? Well, I'm doing a PhD. I went straight to PhD. I didn't do a master's, and it's interdisciplinary by nature. So I'm funded by Lord Kelvin Adam Smith, which do a fantastic scholarship, and they are all about trying to bring disciplines together so you can have, you know, biology and geography and computing science, art, history, loads of different stuff brought together. So where I work across, I'm no longer in the psychology department anymore. I'm actually at the Institute of Health and Wellbeing, which is just next to Adam Smith, and computing science. So my office is actually in the Institute of Health and Wellbeing, but I work in computing science as well. So Cindy Gray, I don't know if anyone's heard of her, is my supervisor in the Institute of Health and Wellbeing. She's very interested in obesity and physical activity. She's got quite range weight cut. Quite a wide range of interests, as well as gender, particularly football fans doing physical activity, so particularly for males. And computing science, I've got John Rooksby and Professor Matthew Chalmers, and I work in a research group there. So I'm not going to go into it too much, but basically they are kind of human-computer interaction side of computing. So I'm going to talk to you actually what HCI is, but basically... Well, they are actually doing some work in kind of in the positive psychology area, so they are working on an app at the moment. But they're quite interested in the kind of switching off that you were talking about, and Sebastian, and what they're quite interested in is how that affects mindfulness, the idea that, you know, so they kind of did experiments where you've got it, like, switched off before you go to bed, and in the morning, you know, locked, you can't access, and people really found this quite interesting, found a lot about themselves. The kind of how much they depend on their phone or use it rather than, you know, focusing on real life. So very lucky to be working across those groups. The actual title of the PhD, what I'm trying to do is evaluate these technologies, and I'm particularly focusing on physical activity. So I had a very much an interest in this kind of mental health side of things as well. I don't know if you guys still have the option to do a critical review, but I chose smartphones and clinical practice and using them, like, for therapy and things. But the resources that I had, and I am very interested in physical activity anyway, so it was for physical activity. They are obviously very linked. I'm quite focused on physical activity, so a lot of the examples that I give today will be on that, but I do understand that Rohan might give you a kind of more mental health side of things, like Sebastian did. So the idea behind the PhD is to try and learn build a methodology. So it's very methodology focused. It's how to evaluate these, not using very strict randomized controlled trials, which I'll go on and talk about, but actually some alternative methods as well. And the idea being that I bring methods from different disciplines. Okay, so the outline today, what I'm actually going to talk to you about is the kind of what is mHealth, and I'm going to be talking about it as mobile health rather than necessarily mental health or mass health. What actually the technologies that are used in that, so what are the technologies, and then that's the mobile part, and then what are the health applications of that. I'm going to talk about the benefits of mHealth quite quickly, actually. There is a lot of literature out there saying how fantastic this stuff is, but I'm also going to talk a bit about what's at the actual evidence level for this at the moment. Should probably talk about mHealth and how it relates to positive psychology, so kind of where positive psychology sits within this. Quite a bit of that is kind of my own ideas, and I'm very happy to have people disagree with me. And a key point for today is kind of how multidisciplinary this area is. And I'll be talking about the methods that different disciplines use. And then if we have time, I'd quite like to talk about my own experiences in being an interdisciplinary PhD student and kind of the issues that I've come across working across in the two disciplines. So what is mHealth? So there's a nice definition at the top there, which is just very simple. It's the use of mobile computing and communication technologies, communication being mobiles or phones, in healthcare and public health. So that's free, and she did a big systematic review of mobile health generally, so I've got that in the reading references, sorry. The next one is a nice World Health Organization quote, very reliable. So they expand a bit more on the kinds of technologies that are included here. So it's mobile phones, patient monitoring devices, personal digital assistants, PDAs are very clunky, you don't really get them anymore. They're a bit old-fashioned, but they're still relevant, and other wireless devices. But the definition I like most is this one. So Kumar is a fantastic paper, also in references, giving kind of they had a workshop of health professionals and from all different disciplines actually. And what they do is they separate it. So they say mobile technology, and then say what actually mHealth is. So they talk about mobile technology is really quite focused on wireless devices and sensors. And the important part of this is that they are intended to be worn, carried, accessed by the person during normal daily activities. And that's really, really important because so technology in psychology and technology in health is not that new a concept, but the mobile part is. So the idea that you can just be, you know, going about your daily life, your phone is always with you, and you can be obviously contacted remotely, which is not particularly a new technology, but you can also contact remotely to and from servers, internet, and all these kind of things. So the idea is that it's very ubiquitous, which is a word that's often used, particularly by computing scientists in this. So that's a really important part of mHealth, is that it's ubiquitous. And the second part is, so what actually, so that's the technologies, what is mHealth, and that's just the practice of using these technologies in health. And what I quite like as well about this is that it's talking about consumers rather than necessarily patients or, you know, particular groups of people. So if you think of everybody as just being able to make, you know, have those choices to use an app or not, it's quite empowering, I think. So if you think of people as users, regardless of their, you know, actual status health-wise, is quite nice. And they also, he talks about providers, so not just people like patients, and I'm even doing it now, not just users, but the actual people that are also users are health professionals as well. So technologies that make life as a doctor that bit easier, communicating between those. I'm actually going to talk about it more in the sort of consumer, user, patient, if you like, or not, sense, rather than necessarily technologies that benefit practitioners. But mHealth does incorporate that usually. So the kinds of technologies, you probably know quite a bit of this already. It's kind of out there in the public domain by nature. And what's quite important to remember is that while there are all these cool new sensors and things, is that simple stuff like texting still is included within the concept of mobile health. And something that's quite interesting, I think, in terms of evidence, is that there is quite a lot of evidence. The older the technology, the more established it is, whether it works or not. The new stuff, not so much. And that's kind of a theme that goes out throughout this lecture, is just that the newer, the less established the sort of evidence is. In terms of sensors, I won't go into this too much. GPS for location, so if you're mapping your run or you're walking, or you can get the location that you're at, and that can help to calculate distance and things. Right, the accelerometer, that's what's used for a basis for your pedometer, so step counts is the kind of pedometer that uses raw data from the accelerometer. It can all get a bit techy, but I won't bother. Barometer is, I put that in because I find it quite interesting, because it can be now integrated into particularly Android phones, and it's for like pressure in the weather and things. And while itself might not be that interesting, It's also for altitude as well. But the main point is that you're providing context. Am I wrong in saying that about the barometer? I'm seeing a few confused faces.
No, I was just wondering whether you were trying to get us to equate depression in a weather system with depression in our minds.
Well, I'm not going to, not equate, but the point is that it's context aware. So if you're doing a mid survey and you're firing people, not firing people, you're firing notifications to people to input their mood state, subjectively self-report. If you also have data about the weather, then you can start to make some correlations there. So that was the main point here, is that these sensors alone might not be that interesting, like location, but if you can start to correlate that with other things, then it can be very useful. Speeding up a little bit, connective to the internet, more often than not. You might have a small device with a tiny little display, but actually it has you've got an account somewhere that you can access on a bigger screen if you want. So it's connected to the internet usually. If they're not, they're usually Bluetooth enabled, so connected to each other. Either whether that's a watch to the phone or your other bracelets and fitness devices. You can get slightly more medical side of things, heart monitoring and all these things that you can plug into your iPhone if you want. They're less in the kind of public domain, but they are available. So highly connective as well as highly ubiquitous. And also important to remember is it's not just the hardware, not just the technologies that you can physically touch, but the applications and the actual app software that's on the phone technically do count as technologies, I would say. And they're doing all that kind of processing of data and things. Okay, so that's a run through of the kind of technologies that there are. What are the kind of applications in health? And maybe to forgive me for this, but when I was kind of in your position or in psychology, I didn't actually really know much of how to distinguish medicine and public health. So I'm going to just quickly do that, and then we'll talk a little bit, I don't have loads of time, but talk a little bit about some of the apps that are relevant for each category. So medicine is largely, I would say, targeting the individual. You can kind of help somebody with a sore knee, or you're at their bedside and giving them pills, for example, at the individual level. Diagnostic, obviously, diagnosing diseases and also then trying to treat them and fix them. And again, I'm quite happy to take any comments on this, but I'd say that largely medicine is biological, is kind of where it's targeting. But there probably are exceptions. Public health, on the other hand, which is where my PhD sits, so I'm actually not really very medical. I don't have any qualifications or anything like that in medicine, or public health for that matter, but the PhD is about public health. So that is, although you might be giving somebody, an intervention of some kind, and you're giving it to one person, you're giving it to several people. And the idea is that it's public health, so it's population level, it's large scale, and you want to uplift entire populations, different groups and things. As Sasha mentioned, the focus is on prevention of problems before they become a problem, and promoting health as well. So interventions in public health are multi-level. They're not just targeting the individual. You can have try and change an individual's lifestyle, make them more motivated, but you can also intervene at the social level, try and, change some norms, see who they're hanging around with, that kind of thing, and environmental as well. So for physical activity, a good example is making more pathways available, sidewalks, if you like, rather than just roads. So making it appealing to do physical activity would be an environmental intervention. And really, the best case scenario is that you can actually target all these three when you're creating or developing an intervention. So what then, does anyone have any, so we've already done the who's got a smartphone thing, but who's come across health apps of any kind? So if you can maybe say what the name is, and whether, you don't necessarily need to say where it's medicine or public health, but maybe some of the features of it, like what it actually does. Is anyone going to be brave enough? Phone usage. Excellent. Interesting. really. So that's, interesting. So that's giving you a lot of kind of self-awareness and really tapping into other aspects of phone usage as well. And just a really quick side point is, I think it's really interesting, is there's a bipolar study that it's not necessarily how you're interacting with an app that they can track, but they can track, they being developers or researchers, your actual use of the phone and other apps and calls and things. So, Jepson, can't remember exactly the reference, but it's called Monarca, and basically they were trying to sort of detect bipolar. People might have heard of this already. And they could do so with not just, you know, the number of calls as like as a sign of how communicative they're being and social, but also during the calls they could kind of tell the speed of their voice and indicate whether they're kind of more on a manic or depression mode. So I would check out the Monarca. It's just Monarca. Very interesting. Why are we talking about that? I'm talking about that because, yes, they're not just an app, you know, your interaction in the app, but actually how you use the phone as well, that counts mobile health. Thank you very much for that example. Is there any others that are just even available on the app store? You don't need to have used them yourself, just any that you've come across. Some really obvious ones. Yeah?
Well, I have things or used one to help me drink enough water to avoid headaches.
Excellent.
And I have even seen some CBT apps there as well as meditation or headspace.
Okay,
that's
excellent.
That
yeah, excellent. I think what's quite important with those kind of ones, although I don't know, I don't think mobile health is quite as advanced as detecting what mood you're in, apart from the example that I just gave, is that a lot of these are self-report as well. Input, whereas what I'm also interested in is kind of the physical activity as objectively measured, but I'll go into that in a second. Okay, so just quickly flying through this, medical, just a point that I'm making, I haven't read this anywhere, but when I was looking through the apps, a lot of them are kind of information-based. They don't, it seems to me it's quite risky to get you to obviously do your own diagnosis and things, so a lot of it is a symptom checker or anything that's like not too risky to have up on the app store. So I'd say there's possibly less autonomy, less that the person can actually do for themselves than the other public health ones, which give you more kind of self-efficacy and things. But that's just a personal point. Onto the public health stuff, just, as we've been saying, physical activity, diet trackers are another one, mood, sleep, and not just trackers, but actually interventions as well. You can get serious games, which are, you know, gaming with a message inside of it. And I'm not going to go into the different intervening at different levels, but kind of the examples I was giving before, if you just think of them in the mobile health context. Okay, so I talked about the mobile technologies, and I've talked about the application in health, to make mHealth itself. The proposed benefits, so these, as I say, these are in the literature, everybody's raving about it. It's a bit better now, people are actually... So before there were lots of reviews, when I did my critical review, there were a lot of reviews of how fantastic and the potential for this technology, but there wasn't much evidence yet. So benefits is this kind of mass population approach, and it's widely accessible. Now, you will note I have a massive question mark at the bottom there, and that's because I quite like for everybody to be critical when they're reading these things, because yes, potential, lots of it, but so mass population approach, it should be accessed by everyone, but it might be able to geographically, so if you put something in the App Store or Google Play, then it can access a lot of people geographically, but what kind of populations do people think this might miss? Exactly. So low income. So what is quite interesting though, that is in places like Africa, but actually the use of and ownership of mobile devices is quite high. You might have that, you're more likely to have that than a computer, for example. But it's just to keep in mind that although it's supposed to access the wide populations, it will miss some. Cost-efficient delivery, and you don't need to pay so many doctors and things. It's quite an important point that's made. So the accuracy, so idea with these new sensors being that, people won't be, counting their own steps and putting them in, or if they had a rubbish day of physical activity yesterday, or they had a really bad day yesterday, mood-wise, then that might affect the entire past week. So just because they had a bad day yesterday, they might then remember it, you know, kind of recall bias, the whole past week as being rubbish. Whereas if you're tracking every day, which mobiles are very well designed to do, then you can see that wasn't the case. They're not tainted by any particular, there's no one day that then messes up your recall of the others, for example. So ideally, yes, they're more accurate because they take less of the kind of human errors that can be made, but you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that the algorithm or the how you're counting steps is correct. It might be wrong at a device level. You might have some kind of weird mix where people are cheating the system and trying to, for example, shake their phones. It's not necessarily going to be accurate, even though the device may say, you know, they did this number of steps. They might leave their phone at home, so it might be a lot lower than usual. And lastly, compliance. So a big one in psychology is the idea of these phones, particularly when doing reports on mood and things, rather than just flapping about a big paper diary and trying to take that with you everywhere and regularly fill that out. So when you've got it on a mobile, it's more discreet, you're more likely to do it. So to say, you're more likely to actually adhere to advice that you've been told to actually fill this thing out and comply. But actually, particularly in the wild, which I'll go on to explain in a second, but really in real life, a lot of people, in terms of apps on the App Store, are a lot of mobile health interventions, adherence and is really quite low. People don't, you know, you're lucky, as a developer, you're lucky if somebody opens your app twice, for example, and comes, you know, a lot of the time they just go in the bin if they don't work for that person. Okay, so these are the kind of proposed benefits. That last point there was, you know, even if all that, you know, has potential, that's great if it works, but do we have evidence of whether they work and what do I mean by whether they work? So another nature of mHealth, if you like, is that it's not, the evidence base is not that great yet. And when I'm talking about whether they work and whether they're effective, I really do mean in the health sense, and that's very important because the diagram at the bottom here, it looks kind of like over time maybe that these are your number of steps, are increasing over time, and you can determine, see that with like use of the app and things, but is that clinically significant? Does it actually, the number of steps, does that improve since you've given them the app, kind of before and after tests and things, and RCTs in particular, which I'll come on to. So are they effective at changing your behaviour, your health, your mood? A lot of the issues are whether they're theoretically based. So a lot of the problems in public health are people are saying that, you know, they really lack theoretical basis, and there's a lot of cases where developers are just, you know, putting something together and putting it out there because it'll make money, rather than necessarily being very, you know, based in theory and having worked with health researchers. Another point is if we don't know, I mean, a lot of the time it's not just about whether the intervention makes a difference, but we want to know a bit more about like how it makes a difference, what's the active ingredient, which is a term you've probably come across before, maybe. How do they work and who do they work for? And it's not everybody. So we don't know that a lot of the time in offline, then what using a mobile, what confounding factors does that introduce? When you've got a different medium there. So overall, systematic reviews, there are growing, the number of them are growing, and generally they say, yeah, it's looking good, but there's just not enough studies, and that's quite a few reviews say that. So I'm actually not going to have time to kind of do a sort of little discussion session on this, but it's quite important to keep in mind about why evaluating health is important. And obviously the answer should be yes, evaluation is fantastic, always it. But in terms of who cares, I was lucky to be part of a project that was looking at the kind of different groups that are involved in mHealth, and users don't necessarily care whether an app works or not, whether it's been clinically stamped to say, yeah, this works. This is what we found. Might not be, you know, the full population or the, you know, disclaimers, but obviously the reason that people were giving was just that they're quite happy, because apps are free, they're quite happy to just take one and see it and try it for themselves, and if they don't like it, put it in the bin. Take another one, try it for themselves, and if they don't like it. And that might even be the way that you use your apps yourself. You're unlikely to use an app for years and years and years. But who do care probably is more NHS or people that are doing these mass rollouts. They're going to want them to be effective before they do that, make that commitment, which are costing money. So a lot of it's money based. But I just thought that was quite an interesting point about who, we find, of course, evaluation is very important as scientists, but general population maybe don't mind so much. They might be more interested in, for example, an app. If you had an app that was stamped as by health professionals as, yeah, that's working, that really does change your health, versus being recommended by a friend, then a lot of them were like, no, I'll go with what a friend recommends as working for them. So the evidence isn't that great. Why is that? Well, that's kind of my PhD topic, as I mentioned at the beginning, is sort of finding another methodology. So has everybody heard of randomized control trials and knows what they are? Good. That's not always the case in other disciplines and talks I've done, so that's good. And what you will know probably, I didn't know quite how long it took, but they can take around 7 years to complete. And while that's a long time for any intervention, it's particularly problematic for mobiles. And the reason being, so I'm kind of jumping between points here, but as far as the obsolete results point goes, if you've got a technology and you're going to do an RCT on it, by the time that you've done those 7 years and you've got your result, then people are probably going to look at it and not know what that technology is, or they will know, but it's not even available anymore, it's not used, or even if it is, people might not be, adhere to it, people might be embarrassed to use it, or whatever. So it's kind of an obsolete tendency to results. So RCTs that do make it to the final stages, rather than all the kind of early feasibility stuff, quite a lot of the time they're about old technologies. Another issue is that the kind of nature of the development of not only are they fast in terms of actually technologies changing and new cool stuff coming out, but updates by developers are very problematic for conducting RCTs. So randomized control trials really want the same intervention from start to finish, and they don't really want it changing between, but developers, when they come across bugs and things, they're obviously going to want to make changes to that, and not just for bugs, but just have different features and things, and that's problematic. There's not that continuity there. You don't know then, in terms of validity, just did one point, one version make a difference? Can you say that having all of them made a difference? And then to jump back up and say that in the wild, so in the wild is the term that computing scientists use, you might have heard of it, for just trying to do field studies, or not necessarily the field studies, but just when phones are actually used out there in the real world, in the wild, not in the lab. So another problem with randomized control trials is not just how long they take, but as well they are very controlled, and you can do things like randomizing, and you can't really do that so well when you're actually implementing things out in the real world. So there are problems there. People aren't using them as you expect and things. Okay, so the last point there is another reason for why research just isn't that good quality, isn't that complete, is that there are lots of disciplines involved and they're really working separately at the moment. So they've kind of got a silo approach, and the term I think comes from when, silos are these kind of containers you might have if you're building a rocket and you want to keep them very separate so that they don't react to all the kind of chemicals and things. So people are, basically the point is that people are working separately, they're not really coming together. Okay, so we've talked about the technologies, we've talked about how they apply to mHealth, how they apply to health, and I have also talked about the kind of evidence that's out there at the moment, the state of the evidence. So positive psychology and mHealth. So this slide is largely based on a paper by Riva, 2012, and they talk about positive technology. So there's also positive computing by somebody else. This paper was quite interesting, I thought. And they kind of not only draw parallels between positive psychology, as in like, oh, you know, let's take some of those concepts and apply it to technologies, but actually how can we use these technologies to improve well-being as well. So they're saying, you know, we should take a similar approach, and it's not what's wrong with technology in terms of, you know, it's distracting and you're not social because you're just looking at your phone all the time. But actually what is right about it? How can we maximize its potential in terms of well-being? And human-computer interaction is very much about it's very experience-based. So it's really about how people are interacting with that technology and usability issues and things. So this paper, I will note, it doesn't necessarily focus on mobile health. It's just kind of positive technology. So I'm going to talk a bit more about the mobile part in a second. But I'm giving some examples here. So they give this kind of aspects of positive psychology that applies to positive technology. So hedonic, you know, the kind of pleasure-based stuff that can come from, you know, HCI really like to make good-looking stuff. So graphs on your phone, for example, it's a poor example, but, you know, they want that to be really nice visualizations of your physical activity or your mood for the past week. But this at the bottom here is a different study, so I took the pictures from this, and it's just quite a nice example of HCI are quite experimental, not necessarily in terms of doing experiments, but they like to try new radical stuff, different ways of getting across the message of how much physical activity you've done. So, for example, the necklace, the number of runs that you have taken that week, you know, that could be the number of beats, for example. And using light, just different ways to give you feedback that's often quite personalised. So I would just make sure that you are distinguishing between these papers there, because this is from the pictures here are from CSAC, whereas Positive Technology was just talking about these kind of the hedonic ambience and visualisation nature of HCI. Also, a lot of these apps are goal-based, and they try and give you goals and structure your life, which is in line with self-actualization and sort of really engaging with life. And also connectedness as well. So they make a big point about, they do reference positive psychology quite a bit in this paper, and I would encourage you to read it, because I can't really remember who said what, but connectedness is very important. And so things like Facebook, and they mention this as well, are really important for being able to do that and have the effects on well-being. So that was someone else's take on, you know, positive psychology and technology. This is my own thoughts, just to put that out there. I think there are parallels as well. I think that mHealth is very new, kind of like positive psychology. I think that they both have a lot of potential in terms of making our life easier, better, and it's quite exciting. You know, there's lots of technology and there's lots of the potential. But obviously comes the caveats of it being very, you have to be very critical of all this, despite all the potential that it has. So there's somebody very excited with their new phone. And final thing is multidisciplinary. So they are both highly multidisciplinary, I would say. Positive psychology, you take from a lot of different theories from different areas, not just within psychology, but you know, if you're doing the idea that stroking animals makes you feel better, then you're obviously going to get animal behavioralists and eggs, for example. And I'm going to go... I will do this, but as I said, this is my own thought, so please jump in if you think I'm wrong. As I said, prevention is kind of a key theme that keeps coming up. Public health are really focusing on how it helps prevent disease, so obesity and coronary heart disease, diabetes, but independent of that, so I think it's actually physical activity is fourth leading risk factor for immortality. So that's quite a, you know, all the different factors that come together. You know, if you increase physical activity, you can help yourself a lot. But it also has positive effects on mood, quality of life, functional capacity, self-esteem as well. But I'm sure this is just physical activity, by the way. This is not necessarily mobile health. But going on to the second point, the fact that it's this mass participation is, I think, very able to do the whole uplifting the population thing. It's the idea that it's available to large numbers of people, rather than individually trying to help people with particular problems. And the App Store is a very good way to do this. So I'm doing a study of, we are developing an app for physical, we've developed an app for physical activity and we're putting it on the App Store. So that's not really used by researchers yet, but I'm pushing for it. I'm interested in it, actually using that as a source for research. And yes, just this idea again, talking about the App Store, you know, this, the idea of everyone being a consumer or a user rather than necessarily, you know, patients that have to help themselves. I'm going to skip over quality of life. Agency, I think, as I was just saying, you know, a lot of time in public health, the idea is that you give people the skills that they can then help themselves with. So for an app, for example, you've got self-monitoring. You're giving them tools to allow them to track themselves, and you're giving them interventions that they don't necessarily need to meet with a health professional for. So you're giving them quite a bit of autonomy there. There are apps that are, it's quite important as well to remember, it's not all standalone apps that are given, or that you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is a lot of the time apps are used within interventions, so you will also be seeing a nurse, or you're also seeing doctors or other, or a community group, for example. And this idea of flow as well, which I quite like. So the idea with ubiquity and within human-computer interaction, they talk about seamless design. So the idea that really you shouldn't, it should be really easy to use your mobile. You shouldn't really notice it when it's there. So I'm not going to read that quote out, but the idea that you kind of forget it's there. And I think with flow, it's quite similar in that the idea is that you lose self-consciousness as well. You just kind of get into it. And I think using a mobile should be quite similar. The transformation of flow thing was going back to Riva, who also made similar comments, but they were also saying about how, you know, the technology, having this technology allows you to then perform well in other areas. So that's a concept I would maybe look up. How am I doing for time? So the other point that I want to make, as I've said before, is this multidisciplinary aspect of mobile health. And this is a diagram of things, people that I thought could be involved in this or are involved in this. So public health at the top, medicine, human-computer interaction and data science, I will go into that a little bit. Psychology, obviously, sociology. Sociology might be interested in terms of empowerment that I was talking about before, and being able to maybe not necessarily, you know, not having access to smartphones, but a lot of the time what the issues are is that they maybe don't, their e-literacy is maybe quite low, so they maybe have a smartphone, but maybe actually using it is low. There is, so sociology is an interesting area that I've not really touched on. So on that side is a lot of the research. On that side is, and what's quite important, it's you're not just within academia, is that you are obviously interested, you have interest from the NHS and other things like the Food and Drug Administration, who are like giving guidance on standards for these apps. Technology companies like Apple and things obviously have a very big influence. You have a accelerometer in your phone already, not just kind of connecting, but actually integrated into your phone. Health kit and these things, so they do have a big influence. App developers, so HCI are very much human-computer interaction, are about developing. When I'm talking about developers on that side, I mean developers who just create these apps and put them up on the App Store and do it as a career. Lawyers, you know, you have patent issues. I'm not going to go into that too much. Policy developers as well, actually, you know, rolling these out and deciding whether or not to you know, use them within big initiatives and things. So I've talked about HCI. They're really involved in user experience. So just over the next couple of slides, I'm just going to talk about the different, some of the different disciplines that are involved. And just to, the main point of this is just to give you a flavour of the, because you can kind of, when you are studying one subject, be in your own discipline a bit. So I'm just showing you the kinds of things that other people are studying. And user experience, usage patterns as well. So there are, you know, kind of what you were saying about the being able to detect the apps that you are using, how often you're using it, the frequency that you use it, when you have these kind of sessions of being on the app versus not on the app and things. These are usage patterns that are actually quite quantitative. But overall, HCI is very qualitative. So they are very much interested in your experience of the app, quite narrative, but I'll go on to this in a second. And they're all about development, less so about evaluation, if I can say that, more about getting new cool stuff up out there. They do evaluate, but their focus, I would say, is on innovation. And their papers, they finish off, right, okay, well, we've done this experiment, what does this mean for the next development? It's very iterative. As I said, very qualitative. So data science and machine learning, something I didn't know much about until I've done this PhD, they're all about the kind of developing the algorithms for calculating the steps. So if you've got that raw accelerometer data, how do you actually determine that, you know, these differences in motion are actually counts as a step or not? You know, recognition and classification. Some apps don't just say how many steps you've done, but they determine whether you're cycling or whether you're walking, running, all that kind of stuff. Inference as well, and yes, obviously very statistical. So psychology, so we've talked about positive psychology, but psychology more generally, social psychology has a large, if not the largest, I would say, involvement in this. Particularly from a research perspective as well, has anyone heard of ecological momentary assessment, or EMA? The idea being that you use an app or you try and just get lots of highly frequent reports on somebody's mood, for example. And the idea, as I mentioned before, you can make these context aware so you can tell, you know, what the weather was like when you were doing that report. Or with sensors, something that's quite neat is, you know, if you're Bluetooth, you can detect who is around you, so you can detect how you're feeling around particular people, for example. So it works at an individual and a group level. I would recommend looking at the smartphone psychology manifesto, which is a very excitable paper about the benefits of smartphones. So it's kind of one of these ones that I was talking about before where, yeah, this is great, without much of the actual evidence in it yet, but it does give you a good idea of how it can be used in psychological research. And I'll go on to talk about how there's a lot of research methods that social psychology use are used in mHealth across the board. Developmental and clinical psychology, I've kind of been going away from the medicine side of things, but there are apps that are able to diagnose, so they claim at the moment, ASD issues and improve them as well. And Ben Zeev is, he's at Dartmouth, and he's very involved in schizophrenia and smartphones, and so if anyone has an interest in that, I'd highly recommend his papers, and it talks about issues of usability and differences in terms of, you know, a health population and what you have extra considerations for mental health. Health psychology is an obvious one, lots of promotion and campaigning, public health, and occupational psychology. So as we were saying, in the workplace, that's going to definitely bring that in, so I'm glad you talked about that, because I'm not going to repeat that. I'm not going to go into this too much, other than the idea being that these different disciplines, if they worked together, they could create some fantastic research. So, user experience. If someone really doesn't like what's on their phone, they're not going to use the phone, and then they're not being exposed to the intervention, so the intervention isn't going to work. So it's really important to get that bit right at the beginning. And health psychology public health, or health practitioners, health scientists, do look at this a bit in the kind of early feasibility stages of a randomized controlled trial. They will look at the feasibility of it, whether people like it or not, but I would argue that HCI have a very good means of doing that. So although there is this linking between subjects, what tends to happen is people tend to work within their own disciplines. It's getting better, but as a general rule, it's quite siloed. Am I going to have time for this? Okay. So this is not my diagram, I feel it. But there's what I'm going to do is just map, just to give you a flavour, is map the disciplines onto these experiments or research methods. So obviously we've got qualitative on the right, quantitative on the left. Just before I do that, something that I was discussing with a data scientist last night is that I have mapped data science onto these ones, and he was saying that data science isn't actually a discipline. You shouldn't really think about it that way. Data science is a way of solving problems, and what they tend to do is use data to understand problems, and that can be used in any discipline. So he was saying to think of data science as a method or as a tool. And what's also important as well is that data science and machine learning is not just in the academic domain, but actually it's very much an applied subject that you could, no matter what your problem is, data can solve it. So that was his kind of point of view. So I'm just putting that in there, so it's very much that data science is quantitative research, that those terms are interchangeable. But what we did also discuss is that the point of data science...
Still, the thing is, if you actually want someone to do it, you'll be hiring a very special kind of person who isn't...
Well, exactly, yeah. I'm not saying I agree with them. Yeah.
They're just arrogant, like all others.
Yeah. But what we did sort of agree on is that the point of data science, when you're trying to solve a problem, is you are trying to do three things, and I'm just literally taking the words from his mouth, is that you are trying to understand the problem, and I thought that's quite descriptive. You could look at correlational research. You're trying to predict things. You're trying to use the data to predict what might happen, which I think is very experimental, and I also think that you are... and he said, sorry, that you're trying to control things as well, and I think that's also experimental. So I'm going to map these disciplines onto here. What the main points from this are, I've done data science already, public health and human-computer interaction really use most of these methods, both in the quantitative and qualitative side. Narrative research designs are very much this kind of qualitative write-up of people's experiences and understanding, rather than using numerical data. Medicine is quite firmly up on the experimental design side of things. We expect it to be very experimental, but it's not just experimental. So within medical research, there is also people trying to understand people's experiences with interventions, or not necessarily interventions, sorry, but why do people not take those drugs anymore, for example, and really understanding issues with adherence as an example. So while we all think of medicine as really relying on these randomized controlled trials and very controlled methods, which work great for pills and things, but they are sometimes looking at the kind of more qualitative side of things. Public health do use experimental designs. Correlational designs are massive in public health, and they are very important. So while RCTs are the gold standard, which is a phrase you will hear for the rest of your life probably, the correlational designs are very important as well. And I think you've talked about it, or we'll talk about it at some point, the importance of correlational designs there as well. Human-computer interaction. So I was, as I've said, I was, and that was not said actually, computing science. I expected a lot of it to be quantitative. Human-computer interaction is not, as a general rule. It's very qualitative. It's very about understanding people's experiences, as I've said, really finding out what they liked about particular apps. Are they feeling motivated by it? That kind of thing. Okay. I did a scoping review of the literature, and I was looking at both the health side of things and computing science. So the actual process of carrying out the review was looking at databases used in both disciplines, and it is not particularly easy. So I'm just going to give you a couple of tips on that. This next section is really my kind of experience of being not just an interdisciplinary PhD student, if anybody's interested in that, but also just actually carrying out research, not just the social aspects and difficulties and things, but actually the research side of things. So in line with the PhD, I was looking to, if my ideal is to build a methodology using the methods I've talked about from different disciplines, and some of them are overlapping, as I was saying. I will put a note in. So as I've said in the previous, I've said here that, yeah, actually there's quite a bit of overlap. Public health use a lot, HCI use a lot, so why is the PhD trying to borrow from different disciplines? And I think what I would say is they get a bit more specialist at it, so at particular issues that are important. So usability is huge in HCI, and that is using qualitative research in a particular way. They know the right things to ask about the app, whether people are using it correctly, whereas health psychologists might not have, or health practitioners might not have such an idea about that. Similarly, HCI know about experimental designs and they use them, and they know about the importance of RCTs, but they don't necessarily, you know, have the qualifications to do that. Or so while they might share methods, I do think there are disciplines that are more specialist at it for the domain of mHealth than others, if that makes sense. So the scoping review was across disciplines, as I've said. I don't know if you've heard of systematic reviews, but it's quite similar to that. So some of the issues that I've had, using things like the ACM, I don't know if anyone's heard of these, IEEE, these really computing and engineering databases are a nightmare for trying to do things rigorously as a health person. So a lot of the time the search boxes aren't very well matched to don't give you enough control. Also, there's just this weird thing about they don't really, this is really generalizing, understand the importance of doing things, doing a systematic review, for example. So scoping reviews are like systematic reviews, but they really look at the kind of the scope of things rather than talking about the quality of research. It's really just seeing what's out there. The scoping review, I should mention, was trying to see how people have evaluated physical activity technologies in the past. So the databases aren't very well set up. Titles as well, on computing science, a lot of it is about trying to get a catchy title rather than, you know, standards within health psychology, within sort of public health and medicine, is that you have to have things like the population that you're working with and what the type of trial was that you did, and all this has to be in the title. If you're trying to do massive hundreds and thousands to sort of sift through titles to see which ones you're going to include in your study, it's not very easy to get that from the title. So there are different standards, is I guess what I'm trying to say there. Terminology, not hugely difficult, but there were, you know, UbiComp is ubiquitous computing, pervasive health is their kind of word for mHealth, if you like. When I'm actually looking through papers, there's a lot of technical stuff that I don't know because of my background, so that may be another issue that people who are doing interdisciplinary research have an issue with that. Another thing that's quite interesting is that human-computer interaction is quite different from psychology. I was very used to the best thing that you could do is to get something into a journal. There, that's not that great. Journals aren't really that important, and it's more about the conferences. So because technology is so fast developing, what's the better standard is actually trying to get something published to a conference. So you kind of publish it in advance and then you give a presentation on it at the conference, you know, because I thought that journals were the be-all and end-all, and they're not in that discipline. Their papers as well are quite different in terms of actually reading through. We can be quite easy in terms of, you know, we don't obviously read the paper the whole way through. We jump to different sections and we know the formats of our papers. They're different in other disciplines as well. I probably don't have time to talk about that or that. Kind of the social things on PhD, the PhD side of things, is actually when you're talking to people, how do you kind of gauge how much they know about the other discipline when they're in that discipline themselves without being rude or, it's fine, like people are human as well, but you just, there's this kind of playoff of figuring out who knows what, without offending anyone. What I found as well is that rather than launching yourself into the reading, so I was talking about all this technical things, a lot of it I learned from just going and sitting in their office and hearing about what they're doing day to day, which I thought was quite interesting. Learning kind of from other people is much easier, I thought, than sort of delving into the papers. Some other thing about doing an interdisciplinary PhD at the start, I don't know why, but in my head I really had it that it was kind of my responsibility to bring every single aspect of these two disciplines together and make everything match up, and that's definitely not the case. So I'm focusing now on something quite niche, and with the physical activity things, I'm focusing on particular methods that I haven't really talked about today, and the specifics of that from the different disciplines. So I'm not trying to match everything up as a whole. And lastly, yep, psychology has really helped. I didn't really have a background in physical activity or in computing science, but to give you an understanding of experimental design is a massive advantage. You know what's a good quality paper and what's not, and that can help. But also just working across disciplines as well. HCI, for example, is very based on psychology, which I didn't know beforehand. So that's me. What I've tried to talk about today is the, you know, what mHealth actually is in terms of definitions, what are the technologies that people use, and how is it applied to both medicine and public health. The idea that we don't have as much evidence as we would like, and when there is evidence, it's very early stages, feasibility, pilot trials, rather than getting to the end stage. And if you do get to the end stage, then the chances are it's going to be obsolete. RCTs are the gold standard. Everybody wants very experimental, controlled designs, and actually that might not work for mHealth for the reasons I was talking about before, like length of time. And there are many other disciplines that are involved in mHealth, and I think there's a lot that we can learn from them, both in terms of the work that they are doing, but also how they're actually doing that as well. The question is, why are people kind of, why are there still this kind of siloed approach where people are working separately, and what can we do to actually, how can people work together? So thank you very much for listening to that talk, which is rather longer than intended. And I'm happy to take any questions. And also, so I do have the reading there now. You'll probably have actually legit reading to give people. But do give me an email if you are interested in doing a PhD in general. And I'd be very happy to chat to you about that, or anything interdisciplinary, or anything in the mobile health area. If you have any questions, basically, you can. If you don't want to say anything now, then you can certainly give me an email and be happy to.
Discovered what your phone number is,
haven't you? Yes. So I got a phone in my office and I had no idea what the number was. 4 months, actually. You'd be surprised. That's another thing when you're a PhD, is the amount of things that you need to do to set up your office and make it your own, and so it's a long process. But something else, a big tip, is making friends. That's actually silly, but PhDs are very solitary if you don't have a group. So sometimes you're lucky enough to be in an office where you have other PhDs in this, with you. I'm not. I'm in a cupboard next to a boiler, so I had to really make a good effort to try and integrate myself into different groups. Especially being interdisciplinary for me is that there's not really anybody quite like you. So you're not sitting in a room full of everyone else who's doing psychology. You're doing something that's quite niche, or so I like to think. So are there any questions now, or does anyone just, you can give me an email for saving time and giving you a break from now.
Any questions?
Excellent.
Thank you.
No problem.
I've posted an early version of Claire's slides already on the course webpage, and I'll put up an updated version as soon as I can. So, I'll just spend 5 or 10 minutes giving a summary of mHealth from a slightly different angle. Claire will know that correctly if I get it wrong. So I'm going to suggest that at least the perspective I take a little different from Claire, perhaps, is that you think of the arguments in this area as essentially about the intersection of 4 areas. The point of technology is about cheap delivery, it's
they're the basic delivery. There's the essential public health perspective of mass programs for prevention more than cure. There's applying this to mental health, and for me, an early landmark, although I'm not saying this is good history, it was true of my personal development, that a paper by Knox and others showed nothing to do with mobile health, but this was a demonstration. This was the American Air Force, someone high up decided they were going to tackle the suicide rate, not that I think it was outstandingly bad, but they thought they could do something. They pushed through this program and reduced the suicide rate by a third. That seems to me just a massive achievement. But it's a demonstration of how a public health approach really could be applied to mental health. We're used to it, in some sense, physical health, but that was a demonstration that you could make serious inroads in mental health. Fundamental economic argument, I think, is that we're experiencing essentially an epidemic of mental health in the number of people reporting seeking treatment. That's never going to be serviced in an old-fashioned way by one-to-one. It essentially must be approached in a public health way somehow. There are already several apps that approved by the NHS. If you look at my mHealth page and its unstructured heap of references, I've got a pointer to the NHS page about the list of approved apps there. I should say a rather recent paper by Gilworthy and others, which got a little published in the New Scientist, published in the journal, and is based mostly on a randomized control trial. It's quite pessimistic about this, compared to some of these early papers. It seems to me, actually, misleading work for them to summarize what they did, because what they did was they looked at patients whose depression, I think, was being managed by GP, and looked at whether adding an offering of mental health apps made any difference. And it didn't make all that much of a difference. But that's not the key strategic question. The key strategic question is, will they replace GP? In other words, which we're of course meeting that people got treated earlier, that they could dodge stigma questions with GPQ and free up other resources. That's a strategic question, and they didn't look at this at all. After all, suppose the app has the same effect as the GP. Which you're going to go for, but they didn't look at that. So I'm not too impressed by that, but just to say there are. And the fourth leg I'm suggesting is problem psychology for reasons of social testing. As I've mentioned, that the psychology is encouraging us to take a view that's about the spectrum that we're all on as opposed to a binary above or below the clinical threshold. It's about the idea that people are happier the further up the spectrum they go. And I just want to vote about Carol Wilson's project. I was coming to check that I spoke to her in a way. Cara got permission to use an NHS-approved cognitive behavioral therapy app, and showed it to be effective for those with clinical diagnosis, and recruited a bunch of people who definitely did not have a diagnosis, and looked at whether working through the app, which is post-bake unit, so that's normally spread over 8 weeks, whether that would increase their well-being. And this was dramatically successful in the sense that 9 out of 20 were clearly had their well-being raised. And in fact, when we looked at the open-ended measures on the odd one out, that was because she'd broken up with a long-term partner halfway through the trial, having covered by the end of it fully. From some evidence point of view, even more impressive is that all 20 who began completed it, despite the fact that it was clearly using more participant time than you'll probably ever use in a film acting doctors are struggling to get TB patients to continue their antibiotics, doctors are no longer feeling like death every morning, would really like to have that kind of insight. The biggest weakness, really, or at least now, as I said, it seemed very clear that participants were engaged by it, that is, although Carl was able to get them to say things they didn't like, that they would prefer to be rewritten in various ways, that didn't impact either their behaviour or the fact they were clearly getting along out of it. So it seems that this implies that it would be safe and beneficial to offer it to people without a clinical diagnosis. It's already been shown to this group of people with a clinical diagnosis, that implies to me at least. Seems to be both safe and beneficial. And that means it's pointing in the direction one would hope that health would go about being able to roll stuff out that doesn't depend on highly qualified medical practitioners, queues, and lack of resources. The biggest potential innovation is that participants were self-selected, that is, it wasn't that we grabbed a bunch of people and forced them to do it, whether they liked it or not, which is often actually the physician's office room. So we can say that it's rewarding and beneficial to those who chose to sign up, and we don't know how it functions in the population at large. On the other hand, one can overdo that pessimism because now we can look people in the eye and say people enjoy doing this and are better off for it, and we've been able to say that before non-clinical participants. So that would be like the next important stage. And that small study seems to me to begin to deliver on the hope in the area of mental health. Claire had a much better and more comprehensive slide. Those are perhaps the discipline areas I was most focused on in trying to think about this field and to think about why this field might be important for society as a whole as well as interesting for researchers. And that's the thing that. So, that would be my thoughts on that. My sort of summary on mental health, but also why I think it's interesting, why I think it's related to positive psychology, and as Claire said, one of the areas you might end up working in the future, since I think it's expanding because it's such an important. I would be able to contribute at this point. The answer's no. Any questions? Okay.
Steve, do you want this? Do you want the microphone?
Okay, so I'd like to use the last 20 minutes on strength. So I asked you to fill in the strength questionnaire online. My fingers are numb, I'm so cold. Right. This is one of the characteristic topics in positive psychology, and its basic idea is strikingly different from probably most people's common sense. So the idea is to focus not on remedying your weaknesses, but on further exploiting what you're already good at. And I first came, in one sense, first came across this in an educational area. This never got published as a study, but I met the man who was in charge of this. The trouble is, while he was still arguing with journal referees about writing it up, he retired, so I don't think it's ever going to be written up. But educationally, it seemed important to me. So Open University has huge numbers of students, most of them mature students. Mature students are characteristically much more likely to be anxious about their ability to return to education than other students. And along with that, especially at Open University, goes rather a large high dropout rate. And they managed to reduce that by training people and then phoning up students just before they first began study at the Open University, after they'd been offered a place, said they were going to attend and do the course, and do a scripted phone call with them, which instead of asking them to talk about their fears, it asked them to discuss what they thought positive things that might help them as a student would. And this was a single phone call, and it reduced the dropout rate in those who got it compared to the other random group who didn't by about 5%. And 5% may not sound much to you, but when you do the maths, you realize a university would definitely be making money by paying even for quite highly trained people to do these phone calls. And this is essentially a strength. Related intervention. So, who did the strengths questionnaire online? Yeah, good. So, when I did it, these were the strengths that claimed I had. One less. So, perhaps you'd like to discuss with your neighbours for a few minutes whether you think this approach makes any sense, whether you have any relevant experiences to the idea it's better not to dwell on your failings but to focus on further exploiting your strengths. There must be, but I'm not clear where they are. Okay, perhaps I could get a little feedback. So how about you girls at the back? What's your view in this area? And what was your top strength, if I may ask?
I think it was perspective.
Perspective?
Yeah.
So you'll be just great at positive psychology, right. And your person next to you? So your strengths are still private, unprobed by machine, yeah. Okay. And front? No, I think that's interesting. I mean, don't know if this is recommended, but it would probably be interesting to get someone who knows you really well, a family member or something, to fill it in and see what their perspective is.
Yeah.
Especially as I think sometimes we really are unaware of our strengths. You know, if your whole family votes in one way, perhaps your opinion really isn't right. And especially because I think a real strength in someone can, especially as they get older and it's just so much part of how they operate, they stop even noticing it. They can't imagine not being like that. They take it for granted. I mean, we wouldn't say a strength is I don't murder people. You'd take that for granted. But if you look at different people, some people are just much better at making a group harmonious and they're not necessarily aware of that. What was your top strength? How are you at the back of this side? Yeah?
I haven't done this one, but I did a decorative strength test. I think it's possible I usually get loyalty at the top.
So why do you like this perspective? Still, that could just be culture around here, couldn't it? I think even the few people I've spoken to already, it's interesting how different people come out with different strengths, and that definitely suggests they've got an interesting range of strengths. It's like personality. The point is it's an individual differences thing with a large and fairly even spread across them. Anyone else want to share? Or say that this is an obviously rubbish approach?
Person in some circumstance, and I can be the other.
No, I think that's a good point, but it might perhaps be more important in this questionnaire than in others, yeah. But it can strike elsewhere. So a few years ago I had a student who wanted to do a whole project on shyness, and I think she introduced the word, and so I asked a bit about herself to get a sense of what shyness meant to her. And I quickly understood that I really didn't understand her at all, because she, well, first of all, she didn't have a problem talking to me, or even talking about this rather personal matter to me, whereas I, you know, you might thought a shy person would not take a supervisor of a very different age and status as necessarily an easy person to talk to. Didn't have a problem with that. I asked her what her job was, and she was a waitress, something I would have significant trouble with being good at. So, after a bit more questioning, it sounded to me as if she didn't have anything like shyness, as long as she had a well-defined social role. It was being at something like a party with her peers with no role she felt she could cling to, gave her problems. And I think that's quite a good example, but in a not of a strength so much, but in a context of how you might, a question might seem to be in, you know, you can think of examples that would make you answer very negatively or very positively, depending on which context you thought about. Any other? Exactly.
If you think that forcible and treating everyone fairly is something that should be taken for granted, it's kind of hard to say that, yeah, that is super fair or something. It's more about failure or other things or understanding. Because of that, I felt this is some kind of have perspective, maybe, whether, I would have wanted some of my friends to do the questionnaire for me, to judge it, because of that.
So I'm just going to make a few comments on this area. So it sounds as if most of you were sort of positive in your first impression about this approach. I haven't read the literature carefully, but I have to say a lot of it seems to me about assertions or relatively weak evidence. I gave this reference, I think, on a slide, and its headline is reporting a positive effect on, but actually they took a lot of measures and only one of the well-being measures showed a positive effect with a very small effect size. But the worst thing about it, although understandable pragmatically, but the worst thing about it is they had a huge dropout rate, and that means that, well, first of all, it's not very clear, at least without spending a lot of time looking at the details of the paper, whether the mean score at the start, which included everyone, should be compared to the mean score of the remaining 60% or something at time 2, or the remaining 40% at time 3. But even if it did, even if they had done the corrections correctly, then the effect would be applying to those who self-selected to stay on, which would presumably be those who somehow find it valuable, and then that would be the remnant, and all we could say is that that 40% of the sample had a positive effect, and we had no idea about what that would be on the rest of the sample. So it's this kind of absence of really decisive evidence that makes me a bit suspicious. But I do think this is interesting topic because it challenges common social practice, as we say, about, on the whole, negative focus. So it's probably worth thinking out a bit about what are the pros and cons of a positive and negative focus. So negative focus may not cheer you up, but it's going to zoom in on things to improve, and you'll probably get a quick result. Positive focus is better at generating new ideas and solutions, cheering you up so you've got the mental energy to do things. And I'll just mention that grandmother effect. The researcher called Siddhartha Mitra, who's done work in education on just how little teachers contribute to children's learning, how good they are if you leave them alone, self-organising in various ways. And one of the studies he did was to pair school children in rural India with grandmothers, literally grandmothers, recruited from Gateshead in northern England. And he said, in the talk I heard, he said with this great big grin, that the role of grandmothers is entirely clear in India, particularly in relation to education, because, as you know, India's transforming fast. All the kids go to school, their grandmothers may well not have. What's a grandmother going to do? She's going to understand even less than a British grandmother about the technical content of what the children are learning. But her role is to be entirely positive. And you know what school kids are like. They like, you see them in the street walking back from school with their mothers, and they're always chattering away, and the mother's doing good listening, but whether or not she's really listening. It's all about positive, unconditional regard. And that's clearly important to children. And so it should be, of course, in a way, because it's through that kind of attitude that kids pick up messages they're quite sensitive to about what society values and what it doesn't. So positive focus is clearly functionally important for learning. But I'm wondering whether strengths is perhaps depends a bit on the context. So if you're in a typical organisation and working in a team, working socially, then it obviously makes sense, and it's what I've always enjoyed about collaboration with colleagues, is how you typically sort yourself out with different roles depending on what you like doing and you're good at doing. And that's not only nice for the person who gets to do what they like and to avoid the bit they don't like, but the other people, you know, each person feels so useful at relieving their colleagues what they don't like while secretly getting what they wanted to do anyway. You can see how it's best for the team, and it's often best for the individuals in many ways in a social context. Whereas if you're instead trying to focus on can you let this person out as a solo paramedic to work by themselves, or let's say as an aircraft pilot, it's really not good enough for the pilot just to do the bits he likes and forget to do the training on how to land. Where it's down to competence, it's the weakest point that determines the value of the overall performance, and focusing on weaknesses is absolutely what you need to do. So its applications are probably a bit to do with the context. Really, all I'm arguing is that both positive and negative aspects are probably functionally important in different contexts. And I'm just ending here on this slide with a with saying that thinking about positive versus negative focuses is probably a wider theme in positive psychology than just strengths. So in spite of the fact that positive psychology likes to, Seligman likes to define it in contrast or opposition to a focus on abnormal function, it turns up in different ways. So Fredrickson's work on emotions, she produced evidence for thinking about the function of positive emotions being quite different from from the function of negative emotions. In other words, both are useful, but they're useful in different ways. Seligman's learned optimism, which I talked about briefly earlier on in this course, is to counteract a predisposition to catastrophization, to immediately leaping to the worst interpretation. And the next topic, which I won't begin today, is about a claim that we're much more sensitive to bad things than to good things. So, in fact, for the keen and energetic of you, you could consider having a look at this paper as homework. It's a huge and horribly convincing review of many areas of psychology. And I'm about the only person in the world who resists the conclusion they've got, since the stack of evidence is just enormous. And their argument in all these different areas of psychology is that one piece of bad evidence has more impact on a person than three or four positive bits of evidence. So that's another theme, suggesting that we're just natural pessimists, and that's why we need positive psychology to stop that swamping us. So you might want to look at that paper. I bet you don't read every bit of it, but you can certainly dip into it and get the flavour of it. And that couldn't be a more respectable high-powered psychology journal either. Although I think every one of the experiments is biased, that's what I think. But you can have a look and see what you think. So the only point about that is that focusing on the positive versus focusing on the negative is one of the pervasive themes in positive psychology that pops up in a number of different forms, and strength is just one of them. So that's it for today, unless there are any questions.